Good evening. It is 7 o'clock in the Midwest, and this is KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week for Monday, February 1st. I'm Dennis Hart, welcoming you to the first in a series of programs in this time slot that will explore and analyze what's going on in Iowa's state capital, legislation that's in the works, legislation that could be in the works, and what it all means for all of us. I'll be joined each week by Laura Beelan of the must-read political blog site Bleeding Heartland. We'll be here each week to try to make sense of all that's going on in the state legislature. Good evening, Laura. It is great, and I mean great, to be with you tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me, Dennis. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
You bet. Well, let's start out. There was so much taking place last week in the legislature. It was almost too difficult to keep up with it, at least on my end. And so let's start making sense of a little bit of it. Starting with the Iowa House of Representatives, which passed a constitutional amendment last week saying that the state constitution does not protect a woman's right to an abortion. Give us the background there, Laura.
Well, first of all, amending the Iowa constitution is a long process. In some states, this can happen very quickly, but in Iowa, it takes two separately elected legislatures that have to pass an amendment. And then after that process, which takes years, it goes on a statewide ballot and voters then have to approve the amendment. So the abortion amendment just took the first step. Last week, the Iowa House approved the text. This amendment was designed to overturn the Iowa Supreme Court's majority ruling in 2018 that said it struck down a 72-hour waiting period for an abortion, and it found that the Iowa Constitution protects a woman's right to seek an abortion. So this, the idea is for the legislature is to amend the Constitution to make sure that no future Iowa Supreme Court could reach a similar conclusion based on the state constitution. And the soonest this could be added to our founding document would be in 2024, because it would need to first be approved by the Iowa Senate this year. Then after the 2022 election, at some point, it has to be approved by both the House and the Senate, and then it would go before the voters in 2024. So we're looking at quite a long time horizon.
This is largely a party line issue. Republicans have been wanting this for a long, long time. Democrats, of course, made some arguments against it. Tell me about the Republicans' arguments for it. I know they think the Supreme Court overreached, but what's behind all of this?
Well, it's an interesting debate listening in the Iowa House that some of the Republicans are calling this the abortion neutrality amendment, and they are denying. In fact, the floor manager, Stephen Holt, denied that this amendment would lead to a ban on abortion. He said that he calls himself pro-life, but that he doesn't anticipate that this amendment would lead to a ban on abortion. But of course, the Iowa legislature already attempted to ban almost all abortions after a fetal heartbeat can be detected. So clearly, if Republicans stayed in control of the state legislature, it almost certainly, if this kind of amendment were added to the Constitution, they would follow up with a near total ban on abortion. And of course, right now, the Roe v. Wade decision of the U.S. Supreme Court prevents that from happening. But by 2024, I think there's an excellent chance that the Supreme Court at the federal level is going to overturn that precedent. So that would leave it up to the states to regulate abortions however they want. And I just wanted to mention, regarding the party line vote, when I first started following Iowa politics in the 1980s, abortion was not a strict party line issue by any means. In fact, about a third of the Democrats in the state legislature at that time were anti-abortion. There were still a lot of rural Democrats, largely Catholic rural Democrats, and there were quite a few suburban Republicans who were pro-choice. The last pro-choice Republican in the state Senate lost a primary in 2006, and the last pro-choice Republican in the Iowa House retired in 2008. So there are no legislators really who identify as pro-choice. There are a few Republicans still in the Iowa House who oppose some of the more extreme restrictions on abortion, but otherwise it has become really a straight party line issue.
So this gets into the larger issue of the Republican Party in Iowa, which you seem to be saying is far more conservative than it was years ago.
Oh, definitely. And particularly when it comes to social issues like this one. I mean, this is an example of the Republicans actually had a trifecta. They controlled all of state government in the 1990s, and they didn't take any steps like this. They actually didn't even move to ban Medicaid funding of abortions at that time. There were a very limited number of cases where Medicaid funding of abortion was allowed, but that was not touched when the Republicans had the trifecta during the 90s, let alone try to pass a bill to largely restrict abortion, or nothing like this constitutional amendment was ever proposed at that time. So really, the Republican Party has changed quite a lot nationally, and that's been reflected in the Iowa legislature.
Given the Republicans' dominance in the Iowa legislature, 59-41 in the House, 32-18 in the Senate, Democrats can't do very much, can they?
They really can't, and particularly not on this issue. Now, last year, when the Republican majority in the state house was only 53-47, this identical text of an anti-abortion amendment cleared the Iowa Senate, but it actually failed in the, well, it never came to the floor in the Iowa House because the House leaders knew they didn't have the votes to pass it. So instead, they did like a switcheroo at the last minute during the last 24 hours of the session, and they passed a 24-hour waiting period for abortion last June. But they did not have the votes. And there were three Republicans who did oppose this constitutional amendment last week, but with 59 votes in the House, they really can do almost anything they want. And in the Senate, the only thing the Democrats can do is block certain appointees of the governor. That requires a two-thirds vote in the Senate, and that means they would need 34 out of the 50 votes, and Republicans only have 32. Now, historically, the minority party in the Senate doesn't block very many nominations, but that's a power that they do have, and they tend to use it a handful of times every legislative session. For people, they are pretty choosy about who they vote down.
Let's stay with abortion for just another moment or so. An Iowa House subcommittee last week advanced a bill that would require doctors to provide women who are seeking medication-induced abortions with information about reversing the bill's effects, information that critics say is unproven and scientifically unjustified. What's that all about?
Well, this is going to be a really controversial bill if it comes to the floor. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists strongly opposes this bill. The RU486 is the pill that is used for medication abortions. That's something that can happen up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. And it's been done for many years. And there aren't any peer-reviewed scientific studies that say that the effects of a medication abortion can be reversed. So there are a couple of studies that are not, that the medical authorities don't consider those credible. And on the basis of that, and under this bill, the government would be telling doctors what they have, notices they have to post in their office and information they have to give women seeking an abortion. And doctors, generally speaking, they don't like the government telling them what to say to patients under any circumstances, but particularly when the thing that they're supposed to be telling patients is not backed up by peer-reviewed medical research. So I think that one, I mean, even though it got through a subcommittee, but they're not fast-tracking that bill, and I wonder if that means that they are running into some trouble behind the scenes, or maybe they're getting a lot of pushback from the lobbyists for the mainstream medical groups.
Let's stay on constitutional amendments for a couple of minutes here. Both the Iowa House and Senate last week, as you know, voted in favor of a state constitutional amendment protecting the right to keep and bear arms. Tell me about that.
This is going to be very interesting. This amendment actually should have been on the ballot in 2020. They passed it. The Republicans passed it during the first legislature. They had a trifecta. And then Secretary of State Paul Pate's office made a mistake, and they forgot to publish the text of the amendment in a certain number of newspapers in different districts. This is an obscure requirement in the state constitution, but amendments need to be published. And they weren't published before the 2018 election. And so they had to start all over. So they passed that amendment in 2019, and then they passed it again, both chambers this year with the same wording. And so that means it can go on the ballot now for 2022. Now, the Republican case for this amendment is that Iowa is one of only six states that doesn't have anything like the Second Amendment in our state constitution, and that we need to add this language protecting the right to keep and bear arms. And the Democrats, every time this has come forward now, three different go-rounds in the House and the Senate, the Democrats have offered amendments with text that basically mirrors what is in the federal constitution, the Second Amendment text. And the Republicans have voted that down because this amendment that is being proposed for the Iowa Constitution goes further than the national Second Amendment in that it says any restrictions of this right shall be subject to strict scrutiny. And strict scrutiny is a legal term of art, and it means that in court, the government would face a much higher bar to try to demonstrate that it's justified to restrict gun ownership or gun use or gun purchases. And that could include things like background checks. So a strict scrutiny standard is like the government has to show that there is a compelling state interest in this policy and that the policy is narrowly tailored to meet that interest. And that's just not that easy. The most things that the government does to regulate our lives are only evaluated by courts under what's called a rational basis standard. So they just have to show that there was any rational basis, like for, you know, speed limits, for instance. You know, hey, why are you restricting my freedom to drive 90 miles an hour? Well, it's pretty easy to show that the government has a rational basis for that. But we don't have a fundamental constitutional right to drive our cars as fast as we want to. But if this amendment were added to the Iowa Constitution, it would say that the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, and that any restrictions are subject to strict scrutiny. And that is what the whole campaign is going to revolve around next fall when this is on the ballot, is will this threaten not only other gun restriction proposals, like on semi-automatic weapons, but would it threaten the restrictions we already have on the books, like concealed carry permits or background checks?
So let me clarify. Is a constitutional amendment ever subject to review by higher courts, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court?
It can be. I mean, there were a number of states had constitutional amendments that said that marriage can only be between one man and one woman. And when the U.S. Supreme Court found that was unconstitutional in 2015, basically all of those amendments were wiped away and the marriage equality became basically the law of the land in all 50 states. But it's very unlikely that this Supreme Court would do anything to overturn a state constitutional amendment related to protecting the right to keep and bear arms. Because if anything, this U.S. Supreme Court is probably going to strike down some gun restrictions that we already have. Now, I should add that when this strict scrutiny amendment was being debated in the House and the Senate, a number of Democrats who spoke on the floor pointed out that even though 44 states have something like the Second Amendment in their state constitutions, only three of them have this strict scrutiny language. And that tends to be followed by a lot of litigation. So, like, let's say this is added to the Iowa Constitution and you're arrested and charged with some kind of gun possession violation, you could go to court and say, hey, this is an unconstitutional restriction on my right to keep and bear arms. And that's what's happened, for instance, in Missouri and in Louisiana. People have challenged those states' bans on people with felony convictions owning firearms. They've challenged those states' concealed carry permits. So it's, you know, the Republicans said during the debate that the intention is not to overturn any laws that are on the books right now. But of course, you can't predict how a future court, future judges are going to interpret that. And someone could easily say that a concealed carry permit system restricts your right to keep and bear arms. So that's going to be the concern. And some of these gun safety measures that are on the books right now are very popular. I mean, background checks have 80-85% support in a lot of polls. So if the Democrats can frame the issue around that, they have a pretty good chance of defeating that gun amendment. On the other hand, having this on the ballot in a midterm election is going to drive turnout through the roof for conservative voters who would support adding those protections. So it'll be a very competitive campaign next year.
And it takes a simple majority to approve a constitutional amendment?
Yep. You just need more yes votes than no votes. Just a simple majority.
Let's remind our listeners that you are listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. This is our first of a weekly series of broadcasts in this time slot, 7 o'clock on Monday nights, where Laura Beelen and I will talk about legislation making its way through the state capitol in Des Moines and legislation that might make its way through and what it all means for all of us. Laura, the legislature passed a bill last week. Governor signed it, one of her pet things, giving Iowa school districts until February 15th to offer a choice of 100% in-person class attendance for students. She has been asking for this seemingly forever since the coronavirus pandemic. She has gotten it. What does it mean?
Well, a lot of school districts are already offering the option of 5 day a week in person. So for many people, this won't change anything. But some of the largest school districts in the state, including Des Moines, Iowa City, Dubuque, Marshalltown, they have had a hybrid system in place now for several months, so that some students, if the families choose, they have 50% in-person instruction and 50% at home. And right now, that is the option that's going to go away. So a lot of families are facing a tough choice. I have friends in this situation where they chose hybrid thinking that it would be safe and the class sizes would be small. Now, if they keep their kids in the in-person school option, the class sizes are going to double because all of the kids in person are going to be there every day instead of only half the days. So some of those families may end up switching to 100% online. The Des Moines Public Schools, where my kids are enrolled, they sent out a letter to parents warning that they're going to do their best on social distancing, but social distancing is likely not going to be possible once this law goes into effect. They have too many kids in the building. A lot of the districts around the state that have already been doing the 5 day a week instruction are school districts with fairly small enrollment numbers, and they may have 10 or 12 kids in a classroom, and it's a lot easier to space them out. So this law is going to kind of wreak havoc with some of the larger districts. You know, in the spring, when all of the schools were shut down, the districts spent months planning their return to learn plans. And now they have only 2 weeks to figure out how they're going to make this work after spending months putting their hybrid plan together. So it's going to be very tricky.
As you'll recall, the Des Moines School District fought tooth and nail against the governor's early instructions mandates that she wanted 100% back to school. They fought it. They eventually lost it. And now many states, including California, still do not have children back in school. In fact, California is almost 100% remote learning. The argument against that, of course, is that studies are showing kids are suffering in remote learning. There's no question about that. They're not doing as well as they would in person. So this is a tough issue for both sides.
It's very challenging. I mean, I would describe this as a lot of suboptimal outcomes. I mean, the governor has said repeatedly that this virus isn't spreading in schools. And that's not quite accurate. It's not really supported by science. I mean, the science is showing that, generally speaking, where community transmission is low and schools take precautions, including universal mask wearing, that it generally seems that there's not a lot of COVID-19 transmission happening in schools. Of course, in Iowa, we don't really have a good handle on community transmission. And while many of the state school districts have mask mandates for students and staff, some don't. And so to say you really can't make a blanket statement like the virus isn't going to spread in school, especially if we've had kids in hybrid settings where there were only half as many kids in the class as they would usually have, and now there are going to be 100% of the kids in the class all the time. And the teachers' unions are really upset about this because, of course, teachers are in the group that are now eligible to be vaccinated as of today, but there's not nearly enough vaccine to go around. So the vast majority of Iowa teachers are not going to even have one shot, let alone two shots, by the time this in-person school requirement goes back in. So it's a really tricky issue. I mean, there's no question that online only schooling is not ideal for many students. And on the other hand, people getting sick and the virus spreading in the community is also not ideal for students. It can be traumatic when people they know get sick. So I think there's a lot of concern about how this is going to play out, particularly since just today the Iowa Department of Public Health announced that at least 3 cases of that UK strain of COVID-19 have been identified in Iowa.
Let's stay on schools for just a minute or so. The state Senate passed a bill last week expanding state support for certain students who want to attend a non-public or charter school or transfer to a different school district. Governor asked for that, and she got it from the Senate. Democrats are accusing supporters of having ulterior motives on all of this. Could you explain all that?
Well, this bill, the Democrats are calling it a vouchers bill. The Republicans are calling it education savings accounts. It amounts to roughly the same thing. It would be certain families who opt to pull their kids out of public school would get like a certain amount of money that they could use in other ways towards schooling. So they could use it toward private school tuition. They could use it if they want to homeschool. And so the upshot is that the public schools are going to lose the money that they would have gotten from that student who's enrolled. And so it almost creates an incentive for families to pull their kids out of school, because if I keep my kids in public school, I'm not going to get that money. I'm only going to get that money if I pull them out and homeschool them or try to send them to a private school. Of course, in many Iowa communities, there aren't any private schools. So this would just probably lead to kids being pulled out of school and homeschooled, or possibly people might set up small charters in some of these towns that don't have a parochial school right now. But it's not really clear how that's going to play out. The school boards and the superintendents are adamantly against this bill. And it's interesting to see, you know, the teachers union has been out there opposing a lot of the governor's education policies, but the Iowa Association of School Boards and the Association of Superintendents, they're a little bit more, I don't necessarily want to say politically correct, but they tend to try not to get drawn into partisan disputes. So when they are guns blazing against this bill, you know that they're very, very worried about the bottom line and what it's going to mean for their districts.
Mm-hmm. It was also word last week that the state Senate might consider a bill allowing parents to request that schools keep their children back a grade, held back to help them if they've fallen behind academically. Talk about that one.
Yes. Well, I mean, I will be interested to see how hard they push to move this bill. I mean, there's no question that there are a lot of kids who are underperforming this year in school. And I mean, we'll have to see how that plays out. One piece of that other bill that I wanted to mention, the voucher bill, it included something about open enrollment and athletics eligibility. In the past, if you transferred to a different school, you had to wait a certain number of days to be eligible to play in sports. But under that bill, you'd be able to play immediately. And there's been a lot of concern that that would lead to heavier recruitment by private schools of athletes. And it would pull more kids out of public school for that reason.
Let's talk about something that you broke, a story that you and your blog Bleeding Heartland broke last week. You reported that Governor Reynolds had authorized using state resources to conduct coronavirus tests at a workplace that had only one confirmed case. And that was after the company's owners reached out to her last May. And today the Associated Press reported that the governor's administration had arranged coronavirus testing for workers at an office of a big pork company whose owners were among her top donors. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, tell us about that.
I've been investigating that story for a while. That piece was more than 6 months in the making. The governor announced last April that the state was setting up what she called strike teams. These involved nurses from the Iowa Department of Public Health, or sometimes the Department of Department of Human Resources. And then also the National Guard was used to bring COVID-19 tests to some workplaces. And it was really, originally when it was announced, it was at the time when a lot of these meatpacking plants were having enormous outbreaks. And so the idea was you get a strike team in there, you test absolutely everyone, whether they have symptoms or not, you identify the cases, you get the people isolating or quarantining, you get them treatment if they test positive. And some of the strike teams were used for those big workplaces, but the state hasn't released the full list of workplaces that got strike teams. They were also supposed to go to nursing homes to test workers in long-term care, because those, obviously, that's where a lot of the cases and severe cases and deaths were happening. And I found out last May that there was this workplace, this company, I actually hadn't heard of it, GMT in Waverly. They're a relatively large employer for that town. I mean, they're not one of the largest employers in the state, certainly. They're not as large as some of these meatpacking plants. They have about 230 employees, and they were able to get one of these strike teams to go up there, even though they only had one worker who had tested positive. And meanwhile, there were this county of Dubuque was trying to get their long-term care people tested, and the Bremer County, which is where Waverly is, they were trying to get their long-term care workers tested, and the state didn't have enough strike team resources. So this was a long time putting this together, but I was able to finally, through the open records law, get some email correspondence between the local Bremer County Public Health and employees at the GMT Corporation, and they said that they were told that they would likely be turned down for testing because they only had one case. But then one of their owners contacted the governor's office directly, and she signed off on the testing. And the Associated Press, it was a similar type of story. Actually, that one, in some ways, was even a little more troubling because it happened last July. when testing was more widely available. But the state sent a rapid response testing team to this Iowa Select Farms, which is the owners of it are among the largest donors to Governor Reynolds. And this was not to a workplace like a cutting room floor of a meatpacking plant, but this was their administrative headquarters in West Des Moines. So they sent out a rapid response team from the state to test 32 people at their white collar workers at the headquarters. And it's really hard to understand why that would have been necessary. You would think that a company like that, particularly in July when tests were more widely available, you'd think that they would have been able to secure testing for their own workforce. I mean, I know business owners, they arranged to have their workforce tested last summer, either through Test Iowa or through one of the other area clinics that was offering the COVID test. So this is something I'm still working on some angles. I'm sure some other reporters are working on some angles, but I think there's a lot more we have to learn about how state resources were used and who received more help from the state with testing than others. Sorry about my dog there.
Your dog. Well, he can join us too. It appears to be a case, at least on the surface, of big donors calling in big favors from the governor.
Well, I mean, that's certainly how it looks, and they will have to see. I mean, the state hasn't released the full list of companies that got assistance with testing, and it would help if we had that list. It would help because we would be able to see whether there was any consistent objective criteria with who got the testing and who didn't. I mean, in general, it's hard to justify testing at a workplace that had only one positive case last May when there were nursing home outbreaks all over eastern Iowa. And you'd think that they would want to get these strike teams into as many counties as they could to test nursing home workers. They only sent strike teams to six counties to test nursing home workers, and they sent them to nine workplaces to test employees. That included some of the very large meatpacking plants, which I would say is, I mean, that's a good use of the strike team. That's where you'd want to bring the National Guard in. But in the summer, you know, I don't know why Iowa Select Farms was getting the help at their headquarters. I'd like to know how many other white collar offices got state assistance with testing.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, we have about a minute left. Daylight saving time. A Senate subcommittee advanced a measure that would make daylight saving time last all year in Iowa, but only if nearby states go along. What in the world is that all about?
Well, this is something State Senator Brad Zahn, who used to be a small business owner, he's pushed this in the past. He thinks it's good for business to have more hours of daylight after people get off from work. And in the past, it's stalled because people, especially people who live in towns on the Mississippi or Missouri River, they're concerned that it could economically not be beneficial if Iowa was in a different time zone than our neighboring states. So this seems like kind of a compromise to make sure that this would only go into effect if the neighboring states agreed. But I don't think that's going to pass. I looked at the lobbyist declarations on that bill. One nice thing about the Iowa legislature's website is you can see the lobbyist declarations, and the Chambers of Commerce and the Iowa Chamber Alliance are against that bill. And generally speaking, they get what they want and they don't get what they don't want. So I think that we're going to be having daylight savings time on the same schedule as the rest of the country. And we're probably not, that bill probably isn't going to get anywhere near the governor's desk.
On that note, we're almost out of time, Laura. It's been a pleasure being with you on this Monday night. Let's do it again next week.
Absolutely, Dennis. I look forward to it.
And that is a wrap for this first edition of Capital Week, KHOI's weekly look at what's making news in the Iowa State Legislature. Laura Beal and I will be right back here in the same spot, same seats, next Monday night at 7 o'clock, and we hope you will join us. Thank you for the privilege of your time, and good night.